Across the Pacifica Network and around the nation, this is Free Speech Radio News for Friday, August 15, 2003. From the still power-outed studios of WBAI in New York, I'm Deepa Fernandez. As much of the northeast continental United States and Canada experiences a massive power outage and public officials bicker over who is to blame, we look at some of the policy issues behind such a dramatic loss of power. And Walmart threatens legal action against St. Louis radio stations airing an advertisement critical of the corporation's labor practices. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Pauline Bartolone with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Investigations into the official cause of the biggest power failure in North American history are still underway. Northeastern cities from New York to Detroit lost power at approximately 4 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on Thursday, leaving Cleveland, Ohio residents without water services and millions of New Yorkers without a way home. Region by region, electricity is being restored today to the estimated 50 million Canadians and Americans who suffered the blackout. However, some 373 flights were canceled this morning from the area's major airports. Meanwhile, experts continue to scramble for answers as to why the grid system failed. Harvey Wasserman is author of The Last Energy War and describes the grid system as an obsolete, rickety Rube Goldberg device.
You can't have a grid that's going to work when it's based on obsolete power supply. You've got nuclear plants that are completely unreliable, coal plants that pollute and are not cost effective, gas plants that looked like they were going to be good and now are dependent on fuel that's going up in price, and as we saw in California, that can be manipulated in very weird ways. And it's just a system that we need to transcend.
Lloyd Duma is professor of political economy at the University of Texas at Dallas. Duma says that we should diversify and decentralize our energy system to prevent such widespread power failures in the future.
I don't think we should be looking for one system to replace everything that we have. We should use a combination. Whatever areas, if you're living in a particularly windy area, wind power is a good idea. If you're by the ocean, tidal power might be a good idea. There are lots of different possibilities. We should use them in combination with each other, and we should also use renewable fuels.
Stay tuned for more information about the blackout later in the newscast. Meanwhile, Nicaraguan President Enrique Bolaños fulfilled his promise to President George Bush this week by sending the first Nicaraguan troops to Iraq. Nan McCurdy has more from Managua.
115 Nicaraguan troops were sent to Iraq on August 13th. And will first join approximately 1,200 Salvadoran, Honduran, and Dominican troops in Spain for training. Nicaraguan Army engineers will work to disable and destroy landmines. A medical team, ironically, from a country whose own health system is in tatters, will be providing health care to Iraqis. The Sandinista Party has taken the case to the Supreme Court on grounds that the law sending the troops is unconstitutional. If the court finds the law unconstitutional, the troops would have to return. With more than 60% unemployment, most of the soldiers going feel they have no choice. The first group of soldiers will return in 6 months when new troops are sent to replace them. From Managua, Nicaragua, for Free Speech Radio News, this is Nan McCurdy.
A Microsoft removal tool for a blaster worm which has infected at least 330,000 computers may not be working. Lee Robartis has more.
A list moderator tracking Microsoft problems told Knight Ridder that as late as Wednesday, Windows Update only checked to see if the patch ran on the computer in the past, not if it was fully installed. Not the usual email virus, the blaster worm roams the internet, taking advantage of online computers using Windows 2000 or later versions. Infections peaked Tuesday, but a new form of the worm appeared the next day. Electronic Frontier Foundation security specialist Dan Moniz says Microsoft announced the software vulnerability and a patch for it in late July, but few home users took notice. But that doesn't let Microsoft off the hook for poor programming.
We need to, as consumers, push Microsoft to be more accountable and more upfront about these things and then generally take security seriously. But the way to actually have that happen is to inform consumers enough to the point where they know what good security is and what bad security is and to demand it in their products.
In fact, the worm contains a message to Microsoft Chair Bill Gates, "Why do you make this possible? Stop making money and fix your software." The blaster worm is programmed to attack the Microsoft update site when a user's clock reaches midnight tonight. Microsoft has been posting alternate update links on its main website. Lee Robartis, Free Speech Radio News.
Approximately 10,000 doctors across America signed on to a proposal for universal health care, meant to spark debate in Congress. James Cullum reports.
The collected endorsements from almost 10,000 doctors refute President Bush's proposals for what many doctors feel is his administration's effort to privatize Medicare. Recently published in the Journal of the American Medical Association, the largest circulated and one of the most widely regarded medical journals in the U.S., four doctors, backed by thousands of physicians around the country, have submitted their proposal to nationalize health care. Dr. Quentin Young, National Coordinator of Physicians for a National Health Program, and one of the authors of the proposal, says that the current healthcare system is broken and that his is a concrete proposal for change.
It covers all necessary medical care provided by licensed health providers. It improves on Medicare by having no $100 deductible, no copay, no caps. Those are Mickey Mouse things that only make it hard for poor people to get their care.
Dr. Young says that he expects upwards of 20,000 physicians to endorse the proposal. They aren't just signatures, he says. In signing onto the proposal, those doctors must be willing to have their names publicized, putting their reputations, and in many cases, their careers, at stake. For Free Speech Radio News in Washington, D.C., I'm James Cullum.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Pauline Bartolone.
Complete power outages throughout the Northeast, which hit yesterday around 4:30 p.m., through New York City and many other major centers, including Detroit, Michigan, Cleveland, Ohio, and north to Canada, into complete darkness for a minimum of 15 hours. Many areas are still without power. The power outage is reminiscent of the California energy crisis in 2000. And as public officials bicker over who is to blame, environmentalists say the power outage is proof of the need to improve federal policies on energy conservation and renewable energy. Yet many worry that the outrage will give the Bush administration the pretext to build more fossil fuel and nuclear power plants. Mitch Jeserich reports from D.C.
Though electricity was back throughout most of the Midwest and Northeast, energy officials say areas that were blacked out Thursday night could experience continued rolling blackouts. Though the cause of the blackout that left millions without lights is not fully known, a heat wave that struck the area and people using their air conditioners to compensate created a great deal of pressure on the energy grid. Last night, President George Bush told reporters that the grid may need to be renovated.
Of course, we'll have time to look at it and determine whether or not our grid needs to be modernized. I happen to think it does, and I've said so all along. But this is going to be an interesting lesson for our country, and we'll have to respond to it.
Environmentalists worry that what the Bush administration and Congress have in mind would enrich the power companies, drive up energy prices, and further ruin air quality. Patricio Silva, an energy analyst with the National Resource Defense Council, says the administration has continually missed the opportunity to mandate more efficient air conditioners, which he says could have averted the blackouts. Silva says that Bush's energy plan favors polluting power plants over renewable energy and conservation measures.
Their big policy actually would probably exacerbate the problem. One of the things that they want to do is increase reliance on coal-fired power plants, build new nuclear power plants. The majority of the electricity generated in the United States comes from coal-fired power plants. So if you can avoid the need for the electricity in the first place by reducing load sufficiently so you don't have these peak demand episodes, that is a huge boon, because unfortunately, on a day like yesterday, not only is it very hot and muggy, but the air quality across most of the eastern United States. Today, I'm in Washington, D.C., it's August 15th, and it's a code orange, meaning it's actually unhealthy to be outside.
California has recent experience with blackouts. In 1999 and 2000, the state experienced a crisis in which energy companies quadrupled consumer costs by withholding power from the grid. Since that time, it has been demonstrated that energy companies like Enron, Williams, and Duke illegally gouged the state. Jamie Court, the author of the book Corporate Tearing, says that the states that lost power Thursday night are in the same process of energy deregulation that California was in the late 90s. And he says the energy bill now pending in Congress will allow for deregulation nationwide.
The New York and East Coast blackouts have to send a message to Congress and to the Senate and to the President that there will be more blackouts with more deregulation. And they've got to shelve the provisions of that energy bill that let utilities out of their obligations to ratepayers in a certain area and allow for deregulation across the country.
When Congress returns from recess in September, a Senate and House Conference Committee will insert the finishing touches on the energy bill. Reporting for Free Speech Radio News, I'm Mitch Jezerich.
Retail giant Walmart threatened legal action this week against St. Louis radio stations airing an advertisement critical of the corporation's labor practices. But the labor union responsible for the ads says it has no intention of backing down from its message that Walmart is an awful employer. John Hamilton has the story.
Welcome to Walmart.
That's the greeter at Walmart. A nice guy. But behind the greeter, some things about Walmart aren't so nice.
That's the beginning of a radio spot produced by United Food and Commercial Workers Local 655. The ads are scheduled to run over a six-week period on radio stations in the union's hometown of St. Louis.
Here are some sad facts as reported in USA Today. Two-thirds of Walmart employees don't have health insurance. And those that do pay more than twice what an average American employee pays. Walmart has been caught locking employees in a store, forcing them to work after closing hours without pay.
The ad has been on the air for only 3 weeks, but already stations are feeling Walmart's wrath over the message. Jason Miller is with the Bonneville Media Group, which owns one of the stations slated to air the spot.
Our vice presidents received a letter from Walmart, basically a cease and desist letter, asking us to pull ads from the UFCW.
Like the four other stations scheduled to run the ad over the next 3 weeks, Miller says his company has no plans to honor Walmart's request.
We honestly don't know what they're talking about because we're not presently running the ads. But, you know, we're looking into the copy as we do with all of our commercial copy. And at this point, we intend on running the ad.
Walmart did not respond to repeated requests for an interview, but in its letter to station managers, the retailer accused the UFCW of engaging in false, deceptive, and misleading advertising.
We think it's abominable that Walmart, the largest corporation in the world, has decided to try to restrict somebody else's speech.
Ed Finkelstein is a spokesperson for UFCW Local 655. He says his union's members who work in St. Louis's retail and grocery industry have suffered as their stores have been forced to compete with Walmart, which offers wages and benefits far below what union members earn.
The good union companies, who by the way pay 80 and 90% of their employees have health care, for example, the good companies in trying to compete with Walmart want to start suppressing the benefits for their existing employees. So Walmart has a dampening effect not only on wages but benefits.
One of Walmart's largest problems with the ad is the UFCW's contention that two-thirds of Walmart employees don't have health insurance. The company says 90% of its 1.4 million employees are covered, a figure Finkelstein calls misleading.
While they say that 90% of their employees have health care, in reality, almost half of those people, they count people on Medicare, Medicaid, their spouse's insurance. They count that as part of what they consider their employees having health care. And so, in effect, they are allowing the public to subsidize them so that they can cut their prices even lower because they do not provide health care coverage to 90% of their employees.
If Walmart's army of lawyers managed to bring the case to court, the company might have a hard time winning. Walmart would probably have to show that the UFCW not only lied, but did so with actual malice, a very high legal standard. Regardless of any future legal entanglements, Finkelstein says his union will stand by its advertisements and continue to air them in St. Louis.
Because we think there's a moral issue here that people, to save a few pennies, are costing other people jobs, and they are impacting entire communities.
Maybe you should look behind the greeter at Walmart and think, how low did they go to offer you that low price? And how low are you willing to go to get it?
With the Workers' Independent News Service, I'm John Hamilton for Free Speech Radio News.
South Korean President Roh Moo-hyun today called for a massive increase in domestic defense spending which he said would help to make the U.S. Army's 37,000 troop presence in South Korea less important. But he said he envisioned the American Army continuing its half-century-old role in Northeast Asia. On this, the 58th anniversary of Korea's independence from Japan, correspondents Aaron Glantz and Nok Win look at South Korea's military relationship with America, attending massive rallies in Seoul both for and against the United States' presence.
Fireworks shoot up into the air near Pagoda Park in downtown Seoul. It was at this spot in 1919 that a group of Korean dissidents drew up the country's first Declaration of Independence, the first loud public cry against Japanese rule. Today, tens of thousands of students and trade unionists have gathered. They're all holding yellow paper fans in the shape of a dove, with American-style stars and stripes on them, reading, "No War." The demonstrators aren't optimistic their president, Nomu Young, will stand up to George Bush on North Korea, though. Yoo Hee-ye is a computer programmer. He notes President No sent Korean troops to Afghanistan and then to Iraq.
Even though our Korean economy is bad, he shouldn't have sent the Korean army to Iraq. If he loves peace, he must say we are anti-war. Before he became president, he used to try to take steps toward reunification, but now he's with the USA, and it's not good for reunification.
President Nomu Young has also spoken with President Bush about large new purchases of F-15, F-16, and A-10 fighter jets, all of which are made by the American company Lockheed Martin. A few blocks away, in front of Seoul City Hall, an older crowd has gathered. They wave South Korean and American flags and wear T-shirts that read, "Freedom is not free." Doug Yoo is a small businessman.
I'm the old generation who experienced the Korean War, so I know what is the freedom. And I need to protect the freedom. And we feel that the U.S. protect us.
But here, too, no one wants another war. Kim Sun-yun fought alongside U.S. forces in the Vietnam War.
I like President Bush because he's brave and he makes good decisions. But we don't want war again. We need a peace regime. We need to change the peace armistice into an official peace treaty between North and South Korea.
At the end of this month, representatives of six nations will meet in China to discuss ways to end the nuclear standoff between North Korea and the United States. Pyongyang has insisted the Bush administration promise not to attack North Korea before it dismantles its nuclear weapons program. Today, Russia's deputy foreign minister called the request absolutely logical, but the American government has refused a formal non-aggression pact, offering only a congressional resolution saying the U.S. has no plans to attack North Korea. Kim Soo-im also fought alongside U.S. forces in the Vietnam War. Like many veterans, he sees communism as the main problem.
We should reunify through many communications between North and South Korea, and six-way talks this month will help us move toward reunification. But first, we need to get rid of the dictator Kim Jong-il. The USA will help us to reunify. It is a powerful country, and we have a good relationship.
In the meantime, Koreans are doing what they can to increase communication on their own. Today, South Korea's state-owned broadcaster, KBS, broadcasted live from Pyongyang for the first time. There was no direct politics in the show, only the idea that the two Koreas should soon become one. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Aaron Glantz with Nok Win in Seoul.
D.C. Mayor Anthony Williams and Police Chief Charles Ramsey were among those to attend a community forum on gangs and juvenile crime hosted by D.C. Councilmember Adrian Fenty this past Tuesday. The nation's capital has been engulfed in a rising tide of gun violence involving youth that has left five people dead and wounded 13 others. Police have linked much of the recent violence to members of four Salvadoran gangs active in northwest D.C., who they charge are responsible for murdering four of the victims and injuring five others. In this report, we take another look at the federal program Weed and Seed, aimed at stopping gang violence, and how in D.C. the program only aggravates relations between communities and local police, as Tom Gomez reports from the nation's capital.
Crime in northwest D.C., where housing prices have nearly tripled over the past 3 years, has been a priority for the Weed and Seed program in the nation's capital, and for the administration of D.C. Mayor Anthony Williams, which has spearheaded one of the most rapid campaigns of gentrification seen here since the urban renewal campaigns of the early 60s. At a community forum held here this week, Williams spoke with community residents. After opening by commenting about the inequities of the criminal justice system in the United States for people of color, and how those inequities are magnified here in the nation's capital, the mayor then went on to call for more youth to be imprisoned for longer terms in order to attract wealthy new residents.
I'm up here talking about, oh, I want 100,000 new citizens to come to the city. Who in their right mind is going to come and invest in a neighborhood where kids are running wild, killing one another?
The federal Weed and Seed program is mandated to uproot violent gangs from low-income communities of color served by the program. Under the leadership of regional U.S. attorneys, Weed and Seed provides grants to service providers, such as local youth centers, job training programs, and schools. In exchange for additional funding, the community organizations are required to cooperate with law enforcement officials and to identify at-risk youth to police. D.C. Chief of Police Charles Ramsey said at-risk youth need more attention. The chief complained that the courts refuse to incarcerate 9- and 10-year-olds who have repeated problems with law enforcement.
Part of the problem is that only the juveniles that commit violent crimes are being detained once they're arrested. We've got kids that we pick up that have 4 or 5 pending cases against them, and they're right back out there on the street.
Some members of the D.C. community, which came out to participate in this town hall, didn't agree with the message of both the mayor and the police chief. Jesue Lopez was one of only 2 young people to attend the forum. Lopez is a freshman at the University of the District of Columbia, and for over a year has participated in Mayor Williams' Juvenile Crime Task Force, a local arm of the Weed and Seed program.
All these nonprofits, all these organizations out here, they're people from outside of the community. How can you relate to somebody who's selling drugs if you've never sold it yourself? My second thing is, I look around and I don't see any young people out here. Where are the gang members that we're talking about? How come they're not up here sitting with you, addressing the issues on why they're joining gangs, why they're dropping out of school? Because honestly, man, this is my opinion, and I know there's people that don't believe it. Police, at least in D.C., their main goal is to protect property owners and arrest young black and Latino males. We need to stand up and make a change ourselves and stop relying on the government to do it, because they will never stand up for us.
Relations between D.C. law enforcement and immigrant communities in which Weed and Seed programs now operate have been tense over the past decade. Weed and Seed programs have not improved the situation. Ward 1, which is home to the majority of the Salvadoran community, ranks second only to impoverished African-American neighborhoods in southeast D.C. in complaints of police brutality last year. Jose, who only wants to be identified by his first name, is a young Salvadoran immigrant who lives in the D.C. neighborhood of Columbia Heights. D.C. police are enforcing an 11 p.m. curfew for youth in Columbia Heights and the surrounding neighborhoods, and are preventing groups of people larger than 2 from gathering on the street. Jose said many Salvadorans in his neighborhood have been disproportionately targeted by gentrification in D.C.
It's not a welcoming part of town. It's really all about money. People feel like this is my neighborhood and you shouldn't be here. Like, I grew up here and I just want to hear that things are getting better, that people are starting to live a better life now, and they're not they don't have to face like all this violence and stuff. I hear things like they're going to build a mall, and then I hear other things like they're going to make an office building. I'm thinking, what are they going to do? Why can't they make a park right there?
Despite the opposition he expects to face from many local residents, D.C. Mayor Anthony Williams has promised to introduce changes to district law to allow for longer sentences for underage offenders. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Tom Gomez, reporting from WPFW.
Controversy continues to escalate over the appointment recently by Episcopal leaders of its first openly gay bishop. Immediately following the decision, a top Roman Catholic official issued a statement citing, quote, serious implications in relations between the two churches. One place where the bishop's appointment has been a particularly bitter pill to swallow for conservatives is Uganda, where churches are currently organizing to campaign against the appointment. Many Christians are even calling on the Church of Uganda to cut any ties with the Universal Church. Joshua Kalimpa reports from Uganda.
A church service going on. Uganda's Archbishop Mpalanyi Nkoyoyo is still in the United States, where he went to attend the General Convention of the Episcopal Conference of USA as an observer. He is coming back a disappointed man, because his mission to dissuade fellow bishops in the United States against voting a self-confessed gay bishop was a failure. Many conservative Ugandan Christians oppose homosexuality, maintaining that it goes against the doctrine of the church.
When God created, he created a man and a woman first. Adam and Eve didn't want them to be a man and a man. So there is no cause for us to go against nature.
Let the whole world know that what the American church is doing is wrong.
The Church of Uganda has issued a statement threatening to sever relationship with the church in the United States. Since the Lambert Conference, the church has remained firm on its stance regarding a gay bishop. Reverend Colonel Stanley Ntagali is the provincial secretary of the Church of Uganda.
The Church of Uganda takes scripture as the authority because God created man and woman to have a blessed relationship and to continue in procreation. So he never talked about the relationship of man and man or same-sex relationship. The Church of Uganda is ready to cut off communion with the New Hampshire Diocese and any other diocese in the communion which takes the same route of contravening the resolution of the Lambeth Conference.
Although homosexuality is widely unaccepted in Uganda, in major cities it is not uncommon. In the more happening cities, it is no longer a rare phenomenon to see same-sex couples. Liberal journalists Shamim Biencha and Peterson Sendi don't have any problem with this.
It's actually difficult to define one's sexuality. I don't believe the Church of Uganda was right in openly opposing such people. It's not proper for the church to segregate against gay people. If they view gay people as being sinful, they should welcome them to the church, maybe preach to them, and find a way of changing their views on homosexuality.
The mere fact that we are discussing this is an admission that we have gays. Gays are in existence. So I strongly oppose this decision by the church. The church must not discriminate the gays.
Not all bishops in Uganda agree. Retired Bishop Christopher Senyonjo is leading a campaign to try to change the church's radical anti-gay stance. He supports the appointment of a gay bishop in the United States, arguing that the church should not segregate on the basis of sex orientation. Since the launching of his campaign, Dr. Senyonjo has accused the Church of Uganda of mistreatment due to his liberal views.
I have already been intimidated and threatened, but my stand is firm. And one very important point in my life, in my service, has been to seek for reconciliation, not to have quarrels, divisions in the church. If there is something which is causing cleavage, I try to see that we try to bridge that gap. And I believe even now in this matter of the homosexuals and the heterosexuals, we need to seek the reconciliation rather than pulling apart.
Even with the appointment of Reverend Gene Robinson, Ugandan churches say they will continue to lobby. And for Bishop Senyonjo, he says that he will continue to work for equality. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Joshua Chalimpa reporting from Uganda.
This is Free Speech Radio News. I'm Deepa Fernandez.